Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Sheena Mead about her work with the Clean Slate Initiative. Sheena Mead is the CEO of the Clean Slate Initiative, a national bipartisan coalition advancing policies to automatically clear all eligible arrest and conviction records across the United States. Prior to joining the Clean Slate Initiative, Sheena helped restore voting rights to 1.4 million people experiencing felony disenfranchisement as the organizing director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Soon after her work with FRRC, she was a criminal justice program officer at Galaxy Gives. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Sheena Mead.
Thank you. Finally, I made it here. Josh, I appreciate you having me. You have such a great podcast voice, too.
Oh, thank you. You're joining us from an exotic locale. Do you want to talk about the cool place that you're in right now?
Yes, I am in South Africa. I'm in Johannesburg. And my husband is a Ford Foundation Global Fellow. And so they were having a meeting here this week. And I was like, well, you're not going without me. And so I came along in the cargo. And I've been working from South Africa, but yesterday I got to enjoy going into town and going to the apartheid museum. So I'm here just to learn some history and connecting into the work that we do.
It's, as I said, when we first got on, I'm kind of jealous. I'm actually very jealous. I always ask the same first official question. How did you get from wherever you started in life to where you were organizing to ensure voting rights were restored in Florida and eventually running the Clean Slate Initiative?
Well, I definitely did not wake up one morning and say, I want to be this activist or, you know, I need to change the laws around criminal justice. You know, this really started from my childhood. My mother was very active in the labor movement. You know, she was a labor activist. She was a labor a worker when I was in New Jersey. And she planted the seed really at a very young age. I remember being as young as 6 or 7 years old, my mom pulling me out of school for us to go picket around the Capitol for worker rights. You know, she would take me out of school because she wanted me to be a part of that experience. It was important. And she planted those seeds. And when I was around about 10 or 11, I remember making sandwiches for the brothers, getting on a bus for the Million Man March. That was the march where a million Black men went to Washington, D.C., you know, just to show that, you know, they are a man and that their lives matter. You know, this is way before the Black Lives Matter movement happened. And my mom would keep me engaged in these issues. And my sister, Solange, was big on, you know, voter engagement and voter rights. And so when I was a preteen, when she was on the campaigns with like Operation Big Vote, just to get people out to vote, just very, you know, nonpartisan, just telling people the power of their voice, she would take me along. And so from that point, you know, in my teenage years, I got involved in community organizing and voting rights for Black Youth Vote. I was a Black Youth Vote coordinator, and I would go to all the spring bling and the spring break parties to go register voters. And I would go to the concerts, and I always think outside the box. And during that time, you know, I didn't know about felon disenfranchisement. I knew nothing about it. I didn't know what that word meant. I, you know, it wasn't something we talked about. Definitely criminal justice wasn't that sexy topic that everybody talks about now. And I was trying to register some voters on the beach, you know, at Spring Bling. And I remember a young brother saying to me, his exact words was, I'm a two-time felon. They won't let me vote. They won't allow me to vote. And that was my first inaction. And then a few times later, I heard somebody else come tell me they couldn't. They were not allowed to register to vote. And at this time, this was not something that they kind of prepared us for as we were doing voter registration. And so I started to look into it and realized that there was a long process to try to get your voting rights back. And so that was the first seed planted. And then, you know, eventually I had my own lived experience, you know, getting locked up and then meeting who's my husband now, who's formerly incarcerated, and he had a vision to restore voting rights. And that's what got me engaged in Amendment 4. And Amendment 4 definitely paved the way for me to lead the Clean Slate Initiative.
Well, we've talked about Amendment 4 on the podcast before, oddly enough, with your husband. But can you talk about, from your perspective, how that campaign started and how you approached organizing the state of Florida? Not exactly a state that's known for being great on criminal justice reform, but you did somehow manage to, allow reenfranchisement for many people across the state.
Yeah, so I mean, it definitely was a vision that Desmond had, and it was a vision that he had that a lot of folks, kind of said, well, God bless you. It's a great vision, but I doubt that you can make this happen. And really, how I got involved in the organizing aspect, I was really organizing on the side of the organization with returning citizens. A lot of the organizing work with the voters and people happened with a young lady named Mila, who was, I call her, she was, the wizard behind the curtain. She was one of the masterminds behind Amendment 4 that assisted Desmond. And so she did a lot of the voter engagement. But the returning citizen side, there was this donor who came along and said, listen, I want to give y'all some money to get petitions collected because, we had to collect over 1 million petitions to get it even on the ballot. And the way most campaigns engage petitioners when they're trying to get people on the ballot, they go to the grocery store, they go by Walmart, they go in parking lots, they go to baseball games.
I may actually
And I
have
just,
been out in parking lots doing that many times in my life.
right. And it's like you like trying to like shoot at a ping pong. You're trying to like hope that somebody will stop to talk to you to get a signature. And then and in Florida, you have to, it's not just getting like a list of signatures on one page, it's one person per petition. They gotta be a registered voter in a certain district. And so I was just like, I'm like, let the campaign do it that way. And I told Desmond, I want to go knock on doors to voters to in like low propensity voter homes and start talking to those voters. And when I started to do that to get petition signed, we realized one out of every three doors had someone who had a returning citizen in their home. There was a loved one who had a person that could not vote. And that's when I was like, my light bulb went off. And I told Desmond, like, we're like, this is how we organize around loved ones. And so eventually, we went to those doors. People was like, of course, I'm going to vote for my loved one to be able to have, be able to vote. And from there, we did like a second chance Sunday where we mobilized thousands of people who signed those petitions who had loved ones who were voters to make sure that they showed up to the polls on behalf of their loved ones. And so we organized around bloodlines and family members.
Okay, so someone's kind of listening and starting to dream themselves, like Desmond did, of pulling off something really big. So often, kind of the system and entrenched interests make big change seem impossible. What advice would you give to organizers as they start to try to think of how to fundamentally change the system?
The first advice I would give Josh is just don't give up. Don't give up. Sometimes this work could be very tiresome. It could look like there's not a light at the end of the tunnel. Doing this type of work takes years. It doesn't happen overnight. We talk about Amendment 4. A lot of people talk about, the success of Amendment 4. It was not just a year campaign. That was years in the making. There was a lot of dry times that came around Amendment 4, where, I mean, to be honest, like we were counting those thousands of petitions at our home with our children, many a days. Having my mom bingo friends come over to open up the envelopes and feed them, having chart paper around our home or Desmond going around the state, me being Revy Word because he was tired on the road, going around the state collecting all the petitions from each supervisor of elections office. And we have 60. 67, 64 counties in the state of Florida. You go to eat like every SOE actually knew him by face. And so that could get real discouraging. And we don't have any money or any funding. And so I would say don't give up and don't let nobody hijack your vision and your dream. There we was really intentional about making sure that we center directly impacted people around this in a particular way how we talked about this issue, people over politics. And it took a lot. And so you have to protect your interests and protect your movement and protect your vision. And so I will tell organizers to protect the vision that you have and don't give up. And it gets tiresome, but the great thing about this movement is that you're never alone. There's people who believe in you, people who will come, walk aside of you. There was thousands of people who was waving a flag It kind of goes like before we started this call, Josh, you talked about sometimes it gets tired. You get tired around the podcast. There's so much to do, but it's just that one letter that somebody may write you and say, "Hey, I was listening to your podcast." That was the strength, I think, that we found was it was that one person who randomly walk up to you and say, "I appreciate you doing this for my son or my daughter or my mother," and that would give you, the fuel to keep going. So don't give up.
One thing that I think we do sometimes is that we plan for the victory, and when we get the victory, we kind of forget that there's more fighting that needs to be done. After you all kind of did the work on Amendment 4, the government and opponents kind of worked overtime to try to circumvent all your good work. In retrospect, do you have any advice about what people should do to protect their good work after passage instead of just getting to the finish line of the?
Yes, at the Clean Slate Initiative, which I know we're going to get into and talk about, definitely took a piece of the blueprint out of A4 book around this one and a learning lesson. One thing I would say is that because Amendment 4 had built a constituent of people from all walks of life, all political persuasions across the country who believe in second chances, over 5 million people who voted yes on 4, is when the government came to a post, like those elected officials was hearing from people from their communities, their voters was like, "Look, we voted yes on this, leave it alone." And so a movement was built to help defend the constitutional amendment. And the thing I would tell folks to protect their good work is think about implementation from the beginning. The opportunity had came for Amendment 4, and we were so in depth in just passing it, trying to pass it, trying to work for it. Like it was all hands on deck. Like no one had time to think about afterwards. We got to just win this thing and let's just get over the finish line. And I remember when we won Amendment 4, I had all these dreams and inspirations, Josh. I told my husband, "I know you're taking me to Hawaii." My whole life and our marriage at that point has been all centered around Amendment 4. And I thought we had a moment to breathe. And we were sitting back with Neil and some of the other colleagues that and people who leaders of the movement. And the phone started ringing. And it was because this was November. And so we're going on holiday break. And we think we're going to have a holiday break. And folks are like, "Okay." And reporters start calling. The law gets implemented January 7th. What is next? What is going to happen? And realize like all the weight I saw on Neil and Desmond, like, "Wait, we're not taking a break." They're like, "No, we got to figure out this implementation. We don't know what's going to happen." And so, at the Clean Slate Initiative, we think about implementation the moment we start writing legislation and working with our partners from the front end and making sure that it's implementable, making sure we could defend the implementation, make sure that the things are there. And so I would say, think about it at the beginning.
We've talked about Clean Slate on this podcast. I think the last time was 2 years ago. Could you talk a little bit about, just to remind people, what Clean Slate is and how it differs from traditional expungement and, kind of before we get into the Clean Slate Initiative specifically?
Yes. So a little about expungement. In all 50 states, there is some sort, most, well, just about all 50 states, because Hawaii doesn't have a mechanism yet. Just about in all 50 states, there are laws that allow people who is looking to get their record cleared to petition to get their record clear. And it's petition if they're eligible, based on their offense, the amount of time they've been crime free, to petition to get their record clear. What the Clean Slate Initiative is taking that burden off the person and taking that burden off the individual, moving it to the state and making it automatic. So if you're eligible, that your record automatically gets cleared after you're crime free for a period of time that the state says you have to be crime free.
And what is the Clean Slate Initiative, the organization?
Yes, so we are the Clean Slate Initiative, we are a bipartisan national movement that works with state partners and organizations and coalitions to pass clean slate laws and help them get implemented by automatic record clearance.
And what makes Clean Slate? I mean, I can off the top of my head, obviously I worked on this too, so I could talk about it, but what do you like when you boil it down to when you're giving your elevator pitch, what is so important about clean slate expungement as opposed to the petition process?
One thing that's so important, Josh, is that, once a person is eligible, that their record should be able to be automatically clear. So right now, across the country, we know there's 70 to 100 million people that have some sort of arrest or conviction on their record. There are 30 million people out of that 70 to 100 million that are eligible today, eligible under the law in their state to get the record clear. And less than 10% has actually tried to pursue that. And people may say, why? One, they may not even know they're eligible because the time periods and the wait, it's cumbersome, it's expensive. Like Louisiana, you have to pay $550 per offense to get your record clear. In Missouri, you have it's based on a judge's discretion, even if you're eligible. And so there's all these nuances. And so it's so important, because what the Clean Slate Law does is, once a person is crime free, based on the state's definition of crime free, and they're eligible, the burden is no longer on a person. They don't have to go petition. They don't have to go running around with law papers and get a lawyer, pay all these fees. Their record will automatically be cleared.
And how many states have clean slate laws now, as opposed to just, you said everyone but Hawaii has the regular expungement?
Yeah. Well, can I go back to the other question? Because you asked, sure. Why is it so important?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing I forgot, we all face in our country, applying for a job, applying for college, applying for health, background checks. So 90% of employers, 80% of landlords, and 60% of college and universities use background checks to screen on applicants. And this is also another reason why the Clean Slate Initiative is so important to people's lives, because people are being left out, the workforce left out of being able to get their education and also getting, securing housing. When you ask how many states, to this date, we have 10 states that have enacted clean slate laws across the country, which is really amazing since 2018, since Pennsylvania passed the first law.
And what states are actively working on passing clean slate legislation right now?
Josh, we're in a couple of states. So, but I give you a couple, just a name, like Kentucky is a state that is working on passing clean slate legislation, Missouri, Illinois, Texas. There are a lot of states working on clean slate in different phases, trying to get to automation. So we're in about 12 to 16 states this year.
And do you have any stories you'd like to share, kind of like from the front lines of those states, places that you've been or where this has happened? I know in our state, we passed it a couple of years ago, and it's waiting to go into effect in hopefully in April. So,
yeah, I'm excited about that. Michigan, when I came on a Clean Slate, Michigan was the first state that, as I was over the Clean Slate Initiative passed. So it was exciting to be a part of that and be a part of all the celebrations and webinars that I held, because it was during COVID. So I'm looking forward to the in-person parties that we could do. And that's why we came to Michigan last year for our convening. Some stories that I could share, one story I would share is, I just left Utah. I'll be going back to Utah because the NBA All-Star event is happening, if anybody listens to basketball. But the Utah Jazz and the NBA Social Justice Coalition, supported the Clean Slate Initiative, Utah Clean Slate Initiative in Utah, and also the national organization. And they held an expungement clinic there in Utah a couple of weeks ago. And it was a massive expungement clinic, also to bring awareness to the folks who are still not eligible through the automation. They did a petition-based process, but they were trying to bring some awareness around why we need automation, because it was hundreds of people coming, trying to get the records clear and also tap into resources. But I met a young lady there who came from Nevada. And so I didn't realize Nevada was so close to Utah, but she was a returning citizen, someone who was directly impacted. And she was looking forward to getting her pardon and record cleared in Utah, but she was held back because of something that happened in Nevada. She is a superintendent, got a great contract at the airport as a contractor, and it was preventing her from being promoted to get other contracts because her record could not be clear. So that's one person I think about. I brought some stakeholders to Florida, where I live at, and also where I have a record and cannot get my record cleared until Clean Slate comes to Florida, because you're only eligible to get one non-conviction cleared in the state of Florida at this time, which there are millions of people who are eligible right now who could have full record clearance if they could just get that one off their record. But I was at an expungement clinic with FRRC and with the state attorneys in the public defender's office. And while we were packing up leaving, this elderly couple starts walking into the community center. And I'm thinking, like, they cannot be here to get the record cleared. They must be here for something else. And this elderly man had, which I know now, like a really bad case of Parkinson's, and he was literally stumbling. So me and another person ran up to him to like kind of hold him up and sit him down in the chair. And the one guy went to go get him some water. His wife was there with him. And I was like, how can I help you? He's like, where do I go to get my record cleared? And I was just shocked. And I was like, you want to get your record cleared? And he was like, yeah, for both of us. And Josh, the only thing I could think about is that, many of the people that I saw that day were getting their record clear, like I said, because they're trying to get housing, trying to get employment. The thing that I could think about is just that this guy didn't want to die being defined by his record, right? Because, I can't judge, maybe he does need a job or housing, but I doubt that. And just the humanity of it, that people don't want to be defined by their like a past mistake. And you see people who are trying to get the record cleared that has had a record that has been like 30 years on their record, 20 years, and they've moved past that. And that they're shameful. And one thing I learned was like some of the folks were driving 30 miles outside the community to come to the expungement clinic because they don't want to run into a neighbor because of the shame that they carry. So these are the stories that I see and I hear, but also the success stories like back in Utah, where a young lady said, get her record clear meant the world to her. She's now a homeowner. She's now the executive director of the Clean Slate Utah Destiny. And so there's a lot of success stories that I'm hoping that we could capture around the country now that, we're coming out this pandemic and able to meet people face to face. But there's so many success stories, but there's so much work we have to do.
Yeah, it's really powerful. I mean, I always talk about how, for so many people that this would, in Michigan, it would mean for the first time they could walk into a job interview and not feel like they were going to get asked the question. Any of us who've been through this and have a record know what that feels like. Or like for the first time being able to walk into a apartment complex and apply just for an apartment and not feel like you already know you're not going to get it. I mean, people have been going through that for decades and decades. And we know the research says that if you've stayed crime free for a certain amount of time, you actually have less chance of committing a new crime than people who have never committed a crime before. That, I mean, these are people who have done everything right and deserve to be able to walk in and have their head held up when they just are trying to get a place to live.
I've been there. I've been there with my husband. It was actually about 3.5, 4 years ago. I think we did like an article. It was an article even about it. This is after the success of Amendment 4. Desmond. His profile is elevated. It was the same year that they Desmond got a proclamation making Desmond Mead Day, September. I think it's like September 10th, and we're going around looking, we wanted to move, get into another home for our children, and we was trying to rent a home. And I knew his credit was right. I'm like, I don't know how good my credit was, but I know his credit was at least right. We could get into these homes. And Josh, we started applying, and the kids were so excited. They packed up everything down to the spoons and forks. I was like, kids, I should at least leave one pot out, right? But they packed up everything. They were just so excited. And after going to multiple houses, we had an agent, and we see the home, we fall in love, come home, tell the kids, we think we found our home. The lady said the owner decided to go a different direction. And after a few of those, the owner decided to go a different direction. I'm like, what the hell is happening here? And I've never seen, my husband kind of have this moment of shame or like holding his head down, thinking like, are we getting denied because of my record? And I'm not even thinking at this time, Josh, because there's millions of people like me who are not even thinking about something they did years ago. And as I tell this story, it's not until this moment that I'm thinking, maybe it was my record. Maybe it was the check that I bounced 15 years ago that was preventing us. Like, never thought that our record might have been the thing holding us back, but the evidence is there. And so, It wasn't until like finally I got to this last home. I didn't even go to the agent. I wrote these owners a long letter, an email, and I talked to, like, I try to humanize this before my application goes in and gets spit out. And I wrote the letter about who I was, who my husband was, who our children was, how they played football. And owner, responded, and she still said, well, we still, do the application. And to find out, the application still spit us out. She said, oh, well, the computer did that. Even though it says if it's past 7 years, they don't pay attention, the computer is the one who's making that decision. People toss it out. And, she went past that. And we eventually got the house. But imagine if I had to go through all those steps and I have some sort of privilege. Like, it just angered me thinking about all the thousands of people who are trying to find homes that don't have that opportunity or just don't got the. We're off to just say, I'm about to write a letter. Like, nobody should have to go through that to just find safe and affordable housing for their families. So, my story is not unique. It's millions of people who's going through this today.
Yeah, I mean, I own a condo, but when I first got the condo, I'd spent there were a bunch of lean years when I first got out, and really lean years, and I was it's embarrassing, but I had to talk to the person who was my agent to be like, should I be worried about them? Can they turn me down just for my record? Can they, I just because you don't know these things, and you're so used to being turned down. I mean, I remember. You're not being able to get in an apartment, not being able to get jobs, not being able to whatever. And so, luckily it works out, sometimes, but that's a lot of stress. I don't think everybody necessarily always understands how stressful having to walk into every official part of your life and have that on your back is. And so many people go through that every year.
Yeah, I mean, even going to apply for college, I didn't, after I got married, I was like, let me go back to school. I wanted to finish my college education. And I went and I had to check the box. And then once I checked the box, I'm like, okay, check the box. But then, like, okay, now go get all this paperwork. I'm like, go get the paperwork. Yeah, go get the deposition. Go get us the, what was the case? Like, what was the final deposition of the case? And so I had to drive 2.5 hours to that county, go ask for papers, pay for the papers, come back, go through appeals process. I'm just trying to get my associate's degree. And so, again, that was in those moments, I didn't realize how much that was wearing on me mentally, emotionally, on my children, on my finances. But yeah, I mean, people are going, and I'm just trying to change that. People shouldn't have to go through that when they turn a new leaf and they just trying to move on with their lives.
In most of the states where Clean Slate is passed, the legislation has been bipartisan. I think that sometimes that gets some, people don't look so highly upon bipartisanship, but could you talk about why it's so important and how both sides of the aisle have bought in on Clean Slate?
Yeah, I would just say that this issue has been a common sense policy for both sides of the aisle. It's a policy people get behind. I definitely say Clean Slate Initiative laws are the people over politics type of policies that people like to get behind. Because it impacts so many people, Josh, I don't care if I'm walking through Democratic halls or Republican halls talking to legislators. Going through an office, I have not yet gone to one office in DC where someone has not. After I'm share my story or share stories from the field, that someone says, you know what? My buddy from college, my cousin, or myself, I've met Congress people who have their own stories. And so it is definitely an issue that folks get behind. It's definitely an economic argument behind this. Bringing back taxpayers back into the base is a workforce development issue. It's just an issue that people get behind. And I mean, there's so many different committees that get behind this issue because it intersects with so many issues that folks care about.
And did you have any feeling about, I mean, I get that everybody on both sides of the aisle, we have been able to get people to support it, but is there something about bipartisanship itself? Like, I mean, I guess the story I always heard when I was in college was that, studying politics was that, one of the things about bipartisan legislation is it makes it more durable,
Oh,
or
yeah.
like, things like that have, so many of the states are purple or red, or the reasons why we have to at least work, we have to start from a bipartisan place to get things done.
Yes, I definitely agree. Let me tell you, even going into blue states where people will make the assumption that this is an issue that gets easily passed in a blue state. When I go talk to legislators or advocates in blue states and tell them that Oklahoma, Utah have passed clean slate, that is what takes their attention, like really. And that's what get people, they want to learn more. They want to, people want to work together. Like as much as like we have a lot of division in our country and stuff get polarized, people want to see stuff that they could come together on and work together. Like there was so much love when Amendment 4 passed and people came together and doesn't like to say love one a day. Like people have that when they come together around an issue that they could get behind together and work across aisles. I don't believe that people always want to be so divided. Like, I believe, I think that's why people like clean slate is an issue. People like to come together. They could come together around this issue. It is more durable. There is much more buy-in. And, that's why we haven't seen so much opposition or implementation issues because we have so much support moving this legislation across the finish line.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that because, one of the things is that we've seen is you see a lot of stories about criminal justice reform and a lot of people saying, wow, criminal justice reform, bad for whatever reason, a lot of anecdotal stories. But what you don't really ever see is the stories of the success. And I know in, for instance, Pennsylvania, millions, and I mean millions with an M, of records have been successfully cleared.
60 million, I think.
It, what can we do to make sure that these kind of stories are the ones that people hear? Because all they're hearing, unfortunately, is a lot of times negative stories, and most of those aren't even true. So,
Right. I mean,
how many people do you
I
think
know.
around the country are, have heard the story about what's happening in Pennsylvania, and how many, I know they're trying to advertise that point, but.
Yeah, there's two parts of the story. It's the success of the legislation passing, but the story that we have to tell is also like the humanizing part, Josh, of like what happens when someone doesn't have a clean slate? Because I think that becomes shocking to people. Like when you give the stats to people, how many people are removed from trying to get housing, employment, jobs, or when one in two children have a parent with a record, or when you tell people, how many people have a record, how easy it is for somebody to have a record, how it sticks with them. People are like, that's just messed up, right? And then you show them how it impacts their community or person and how it just trickles around. And then when you show them like how like the solution, like what happened in Pennsylvania, that's when people really get excited. So it is also telling the other side of the story, right? Around how mass incarceration has impacted our country and our communities, and then how we have solutions to fix it. And so it's telling the whole story, but I'm committed to telling the stories of the successes of Pennsylvania and Michigan as we start implementing there in Utah. But it's also like the narrative change work that we have to do as a movement, like what you're doing, Decarceration Nation, coming on podcasts, talking about it, capturing real people's stories. And also getting legislators, lifting them up when they do right by passing legislation like this, because they love to, be toted up on great legislation that they pass in the communities and supporting them, and our organizations and partners when legislation passed. So I think we just have to all do it together and just making sure that we're pushing to tell the stories. And now that, in this new season where we're able to again capture stories, get out there on the ground, grounding the ground, grounded. I think there's opportunity for us to like really share the success of Clean Slate and how it could like impact millions of lives generationally.
And you are, you said earlier that you had your first convening in Michigan last year, which luckily I was able to attend. You're having your second national convening in early June in Oklahoma. Would you like to talk about that event and what people should be looking forward to? Also, why Oklahoma? I think you mentioned it a
Yes,
little bit before.
we had so much fun in Detroit, and it
Oh, I
was
should
so
probably mention,
empowering.
I spent a lot of my life in Oklahoma. So this is my parents and my
Oh,
family
really?
all. My family all lives
Oh,
in Oklahoma, so yeah.
so we know we can see you in Oklahoma then, right?
There's a good chance.
There's a good chance. We better see you in Oklahoma. We came to your state. We came back to your hometown first last year. Yeah, Oklahoma. Why Oklahoma? We want to show like also the contrast and wins. Like we was in Michigan, we was in which is considered a blue state. Now we're going to a red state where we had success, and Oklahoma is starting to implement a clean slate there. And we have some great advocates that when we talk about bipartisanship that came together that are very unlikely bedfellows that came together to pass clean slate. I'm really excited to go there and convene our advocates, directly impacted people, stakeholders, and really come together and show that this is a movement that's happening across the country and bring people together for learned lessons, like learning from the coalitions in Michigan and Utah, and even bringing together maybe this year some agency folks, and learning and researchers. And so it's a great opportunity. I'm looking forward to us really bring a lot more people together. I think we had about 175 people last year, and that was our first time. And we were just like, let's just do this thing. We just took a leap of faith. And so this year we're looking to 2 to 250 people come together in Oklahoma and really hoping to really get folks excited about what's ahead in all the new states, especially states where we are not actively working, who are interested in clean slate. We want them to come to the table as well so they can learn and really understand what makes good clean slate laws.
I forgot to ask this a little bit earlier, but one of the things that's really important to getting things done is getting a good team of people together. And I know you've spent a lot of time doing that. Do you want to talk? I mean, all these things that are happening across the country, all the things. Do you want to talk a little bit about the team you have and how you think about putting a team together to do this kind of work?
Well, we have, well, let me tell you, I have a kick-ass, if I can say that on your
You
podcast,
can. It's
kick-ass
a
team at the
podcast.
Clean
It's one of
Slate
the nice
Initiative.
things about podcasts is you can say,
We have a kick-ass team at the Clean Slate Initiative. We are a small but mighty group, but we're expanding. Josh, when you and I met, it was just like myself and like three other people. And by the end of the year, we probably would be staffed up to 30 folks by the end of the year. And so we're bringing on, we just hired a legislative director. I'm so excited about a research director that's going to really like dig into some of the research. We have our campaigns team that digs in, but it's not just about our team. It's about the teams that we build and bridge gaps together in the states. And so the secret sauce about the Clean Slate Initiative is not just our team. It is how we work with state partners. It is really coming into a state, working with people that's on the ground who's been doing this work for years, who want to move clean slate legislation, who has the relationships on the ground, who wants to move legislation, and bringing them together with business, faith, community, directly impacted groups, grassroots groups, and advocates to bring together a very strong, durable coalition that can move legislation. So really the secret sauce, as much as our team wants to take credit and we are kick ass, it is working with these great state partners on a state level. And our national partners, we have some great national partners from CAP to Right on Crime to ACU. And so we're very, we have a broad coalition. And I think that's a really unique thing about the Clean Slate Initiative.
We've just gotten past, thankfully, an election season where criminal justice was also often on the ballot. We talked a lot about specific parts of the movement, but do you have any thoughts on where we are as a movement and what we're going to need to do as an entire, like, criminal justice reform movement across the country to get past kind of this never-ending politics of tough on crime that just seems to, like, no matter what the facts are, we're going to hear the same stories over and over again.
Yeah, if anybody out there knows the answer, y'all call me and let me know. Because I know we're
Think
all trying to figure
we
it
all
out.
struggle with that for sure, yeah.
We're all struggling. We're all trying to figure it out how to get past this narrative. And to be honest, ever since the elections ended, you don't hear all this tough on crime stuff anymore as much. Like I haven't really
Shocking,
heard
right?
anything. It's like the plug got pulled. It was like, what happened? And so, I just think we just have to do better in counteracting those messages and those narratives and get out there and tell our stories and in places where if crime is rising, but we're not saying that that crime is not happening in places. Like it's not us denying it, but it's also let's talk about the reforms we have done to help lower recidivism and also lower the crime rate and how things are better and how recidivism is low. Like, we have to do better telling our story and successes. Kind of go back to what you said earlier, like what was happening in Pennsylvania. Did we talk about all the jobs that people have now? Have we talked about all the opportunities that are now there? And so I just think, media and movies and stuff is sensationalizes stuff, and in the elections times it just bubbles up. But I will say that after the elections happened, I haven't heard as much of this tough on crime. And it's unfortunate because we see, because of the tough on crime narrative, that legislators and elected officials shy away from passing really good reforms because they're worried about getting reelected. And so how can we work with our elected officials and also, work with them around this narrative stuff and give coverage and stuff? So we're all trying to figure it out, Josh.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So what else should people be looking forward to from the Clean Slate Initiative in 2023 and beyond?
Well, I would say that there's going to be some big announcements coming around Clean Slate Initiative prior to our convening. The biggest thing is that, we have momentum. There are states that are reaching out to us left and right, and states that we're working with, and we realize that we do not want to stop until every state is on a pathway to automation, until we could get folks a second chance to get their records automatically cleared. So 2023 and beyond, we're looking to really move the federal legislation. There's an opportunity on a federal level where there's no mechanism to get your record cleared or petition to get your record cleared at the federal level. And so we're really excited about trying to see some more movement with our National Clean Slate Act bill and the Fresh Start Act, and working in states across the country. And so I just tell folks, if you want to get involved in this movement, to definitely to go to cleanslateinitiative.org. We'll connect you with our active campaigns, with our great partners on the ground, if you want to learn more about the work that we're doing.
Earlier, you mentioned the Million Man March. And
Yes.
so I always ask this question at the end about like books that people want to recommend. But I first want to say that everyone should check out the Spike Lee movie Get on the Bus, which is about the Million Man March, or taking the
Yeah.
trip to the Million Man March.
Yeah.
It's a movie I've always enjoyed. But I do like to ask people if there are any criminal justice related books that they might recommend to our listeners. Do you have any favorite books?
I do have a favorite book, Josh. It may surprise you, but it's Let My People Vote. It is a
And who's
love
that
story. It is
by?
by Desmond Mead, and it is on Audible as well. And I would tell folks, I would encourage folks, who, like, I don't got time to read another book right now, but you have time while you're driving to work or while you're working at your office to listen to the Audible. It's in Desmond's voice. But it's not just about criminal justice reform. It's about people coming together around the issue that they care about, around second chances, around love that ultimately gave 1.4 million people back the right to vote. And so it is definitely an inspiring book. Let you know that, we can talk to people from across the aisle and folks unlikely bedfellows to make change in our world. And I definitely it's encourage folks to check out Let My People Vote.
I don't know if people know this or not, for the people who watch on YouTube, that this bookshelf behind me, I switch around the books that are in the camera, and there have been times when I definitely put that book out there, and I'll do it again because it is a very good book. So I always ask the same last question: what did I mess up? What question should I have asked you but did not?
I think you've asked a lot of questions, but you didn't ask me how does me having a record impact my life?
Well, let's pretend I asked it and let's hear your answer.
Yes. It wasn't until this year, Josh, that I decided to take the journey, and I'm gonna probably blog it, the journey to actually try to get my record clear. And I think that it was something that I kind of put in the back of my mind. I knew it impacted me, but I've been blessed to be able to have employment more so like in the movements type spaces where you don't have to always check a box, like you're not checking boxes, right? They're looking for people with lived experience and who wants to do the work. But it has been this thing that I didn't realize that brought a lot of shame and never really talked about it around to my kids. And Being able to lead the Clean Slate Initiative has been able to kind of unlock that for me to really talk about my own record and how I got my record and how it's impacted myself, my children, my career, going to school, and now. And so I understand directly that pain that it can bring having a record, and I try to make sure I don't let that feeling leave me as I try to push forward in the work that I do with the Clean Slate Initiative. So if that was one question, it would be that, because I often don't get asked, because sometimes people may not assume that I have a record. It's not something we lead with. It's not a look that you have. It's not, but there are many people that look like me that may be CEOs and business or in a career, married, and kids are grown, college degrees, but still have this Charlotte of shame that sticks with them. And so that is how my record has impacted me in the past, but now it's given me fuel to make sure that, again, 70 to 100 million people have a chance at a second chance.
That's a great place to finish this up. Thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope you have a great time in Johannesburg.
Josh, I appreciate you finally having on. I know I kind of like stalked you and chased you around in Detroit. Was like, when the other media is going to get on here on Twitter? But I'm a fan of your work, and so I appreciate being on the podcast, and continue to do the great work you're doing, getting stories of real people out there.
Well, thanks so much, and I really am glad we finally. I'm sorry it took so long to get you on.
Right.
And now, my take. Thanks so much to my friend Sheena Mead for joining me this week. There are few more impactful policies than Clean Slate for helping people to get their lives back on track. Today, I have a personal announcement. After nearly 4 years at Safe and Just Michigan, I've decided to take a job as Criminal Justice Policy Manager at Dream.org. Unless I messed up getting this episode produced, today was my first day at this new job. This was a very hard decision for me. Working at Safe and Just Michigan was a real honor and a privilege, and I love everyone that I've worked with. I'll miss the entire team and all of the great work we were doing together. I'm also very excited to start working with the amazing team at Dream.org, starting with my good friend and frequent Decarceration Nation guest, Janos Martin. I'm fired up to start this new chapter in my life and get to work with formerly incarcerated activists all across the country to make real change happen. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Make sure and add us on social media and share our posts across your networks. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.